the legal stuff until January 2022.
Well, I'm really kind of blown away by the legal research, and I guess it's right up your alley being a paralegal, but it's a lot of stuff that I think people don't really realize how deep the legal ramifications go. And I think that there are a lot of dots there that connect and will connect for a lot of people when they hear about your work. So I watched your presentation a few weeks ago. And you have that look of someone who has stumbled, who has uncovered some truths, right? You have that 1,000-yard stare that people who have tumbled pretty far down the rabbit hole have. So I'd like to just have you kind of run through some of the big points that you've uncovered. So what a person believes about a story, I feel, is directly related to when they believe that story begins. When does this story begin? Take us back as far as we need to.
Well, because I'm a Catholic, I think it goes back to the fall of Lucifer, but that's
That's right.
not maybe particularly relevant to this discussion. It is relevant, but then I think the phase that it's in now goes back to the somewhere around 1910, 1913 with the Federal Reserve Act. There was a lot of stuff going on. I've been reading recently a lot of encyclicals by Pope Leo XIII, who wrote a lot about Freemasonry, and he cited back to the first popes that were dealing with that head on, and they trace it to like early to mid 1700s, and then by the end of the 1800s, it was getting much more open about the infiltration of sovereign governments and the things they were doing to suppress Christianity and convert all the power, political power, and social, civil, influence power to non-religious authorities by themselves. So that escalated in the late 1800s, and then by 1913 is when they got some of the ones that are most, they're felt most intensely now, starting with the Federal Reserve Act, I would say. And then for the actual public health piece, incrementally added on, I think this, I now think, did not think this before, but I now think Spanish flu was part of the like medicalized merging of like biological medical weapon systems with financial weapon systems with political power, and then that sort of hit its like structural, what we recognize now as the structure was the 1944 Public Health Service Act.
Tell us a little bit about what that act was and what the implications have been over the last couple of decades. I find it very interesting that you say this story begins a few hundred years ago. It's like the more you dig into this, the more you realize that the further back you have to go. I mean, this is something that I think at first blush, people think, well, it's been a few years in the making. And then you dig a little bit deeper and you're like, it's been a few decades in the making. And then you dig deeper and it's like a century. And then you realize it's been several centuries in the making.
And it gets hard to figure out where to stop digging, and it gets hard to figure out where to start talking about it, and it gets hard to figure out where to start trying to intervene and change course based on all of these different time frames you can look at. But the Public Health Service Act, I think it was mostly a consolidation. There had been a military aspect to public health in the United States before that, but it was fragmented among several different departments and programs. And I think because of the way the US government was kind of coordinating with the Nazi government and testing out some mechanisms for population control and depopulation, they took the lessons of the Nazi programs and they wanted them to be less visible but more effective. And so that's my interpretation of what the 1944 Public Health Service Act did. It brought together these different departments and put them in like a single military branch pretending to be about public health.
Tell us about this transformation, because I've become obsessed now with this idea that the transfer of power has now gone into health authorities. And I think that's because they feel that everyone's afraid of death, right? And so if you get a scientist who's scaring you about a big, bad disease, you're probably going to pay attention. As opposed to, let's say, an army general who said, you know, who says we're trying to exert control over you, you're going to be a little bit more inclined to resist that. But a scientist who tells you this disease is harmful, and unless you do A, B, and C, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. People behave like they become very, very timid and they fall in line very, very quickly. Is that what your research has found?
Yeah, and I think the other benefit of making it medicalized is the invisibleness of the enemy. Like, it has always been effective to scare people about an external enemy to get them to cooperate with otherwise evil internal enemies. Like, you say, well, we're under attack. You have to just shut up and do what we say. But using viruses and bacteria and communicable diseases and things that people can't see and saying those are the threat that you need to drop everything and listen to what we say and do what we say if you want to live is even more effective for them because you can't see it. You can't, like, you can see it if you do detailed testing and stuff, but you can get a lot more panic out of an invisible enemy. Like, it's just all around you. And that's why the masks were such a stroke of diabolical genius, because they did that a bit in 1918 and they did it again this time. And it sends a visual signal all the time that the people around you think there's something threatening going on, but they can't see it. And they think that this paper thing is going to protect them. And they think that if you don't have it on, you're even more of a threat. A lot of it, I think the benefit was the invisible enemy aspect.
I think that is so smart. Tell us about the 1960s and the onset of these biological warfare programs.
So I'm still digging a lot in that area. It looks like there was a movement around the world to sort of not have, to prohibit biological warfare and chemical warfare because of things that happened in World War I and World War II. Like, the Geneva Conventions came out of that, different things like that. And so in the 60s, at the same time that some of the genetic research was taking off, they wanted to keep doing that research, but they didn't want to get in trouble from the international community that was trying to block or stop that kind of stuff. And so the solution they came up with, which again is extremely intelligent and diabolical, was just to conflate them, to say on the one hand, we're not going to do any biological and chemical warfare weapons research anymore, but just in case other people are doing it, we're going to do lots and lots of research about things to defend ourselves. And so we're going to have to keep stockpiles of these weapons, and we're going to have to develop new strains of these pathogens so that we can test protective, prophylactic, military defense type things. And in that way, they were able to set the foundation, set the funding, set up all the organizations to do it, and then build on that all the way up to now.
Tell us about these dual tracks, because this I'm fascinated with. The dual tracks of the military and the worldwide financial coercion that takes place. Because this, when I heard this, I said, my God, you know, when COVID first happened, there were a lot of people who saw kind of halfway through it. And they said, well, this is about drug companies wanting to make a lot of money. And I'm sure that was an aspect of it. But a drug company can't get 110 or 120 countries to fall in line and all institute the same policies. This went far, far beyond that. And your research kind of points to that as well.
Yeah. I think it was probably Todd Callender's, that original interview he did with Elizabeth Lee Bleat. He talked also about the Bank for International Settlements and their role in central banking at the nation state level as like the central bank of central bankers.
Right.
And so because they were instrumental in the great financial collapse in 2008, and they go back to 1930, that's when BIS was put together.
Right.
And it was put together allegedly to manage the like reparations process for German post-World War I reparations from Germany to other countries. But I think that was pretextual because they had wanted that kind of centralized mechanism for a long time. And then because they could also fund both sides of different wars to collapse economies and collapse currencies and collapse governments, they could set things up to make that like they do now. They set up a crisis and then they put themselves forward as the response that will help resolve that crisis that they themselves caused.
Right.
And so they, by 2019 was when the repo crisis was going on that summer, and they already had the like great reset, central bank digital currencies, all that sort of mechanistic stuff ready to go, but they needed the crisis that would allow them to shut down the economy and increase dependency for the central banks and for families and for businesses. And so that was what COVID was for, to like give them the reason to shut everything down and consolidate power.
You know, I think often about the president of Belarus, who a couple of years ago said that the IMF offered me a $1 million bribe to lock down my country, and I refused. I mean, this goes right in line with what you're saying. And then, of course, there's, you know, several African leaders of African nations who stood up against the lockdowns and said, no way, we're not doing this. And they mysteriously came down with illnesses and
sudden
died.
Heart attacks. Yeah.
And sudden heart attacks. So this is the game they play, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, they don't even have to kill that many of the leaders for the rest of the leaders to figure out like, oh, we should just go along because we can see what happens to the ones who don't.
So when does the DOD take over public health as policy in the nation, in this country?
I think probably also in that late 60s period. 1983 was the Public Health Emergencies Program getting installed, and that was a way of conflating national emergency, national security emergency, and public health emergency, so that any of the three or any combination or variation of the three would be enough to trigger all of the suspension of constitutional rights and other laws, and put it in the hands of the Health and Human Services Secretary and the Defense Secretary working through this committee. And then they built up the committee, the Public Health Emergency Medical Countermeasures Enterprise, I think showed up around like the late 90s, early 2000s. But yeah, I would say starting in the late 60s is when they started making the weaving it together. And then over time, they weave it more and more tightly together.
You know, I was, you talk about the countermeasures. I was fascinated by this. So you write on your Substack, the use of EUA covered medical countermeasure products, including masks, PCR tests, mRNA and DNA injections. And now you're quoting, shall not be considered to constitute a clinical investigation. And you go on to write, this is true no matter how untested, unmonitored, unsafe, or ineffective they are. But then you go on, and this is what we alluded to a moment ago, you go on to lay out the legal implications of this, and you lay out a couple of dozen. I'm just going to highlight a few. There's no treatment group or control group. So this is why a vaccine can be tested on 8 mice or whatever it is and rolled out to the public without any objection. There's no coordinated public federal government monitoring of recipients after receiving the products for adverse effects and deaths. This is why no one's keeping statistics mm-hmm. on people who have died or suffered adverse effects. There are no marketing standards. Mm-hmm. This is why they're not required to give you the laundry list of side effects like we see on when commercials play on television on about new drugs. And most importantly, this is what really got my attention. There's no stopping condition.
Yeah.
There's no trigger that halts the rollout of these products, no matter how many people die or how many people suffer adverse effects. These are real legal ramifications that we're living with every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's because they're weapons, they're not drugs. That's what the countermeasures language means and is also intended to obscure from the general public. So I think that there probably are industrial complex, whatever you want to call it. They want to know how well different formulations work at mm-hmm. making people sick, triggering cancers, triggering neurological problems, killing people. I am not sure if they have to report that to Congress anymore, because one of the things that I have tracked is how Congress eviscerated its own right to get information from the DOD about the chemical and biological warfare program.
They relinquished that right?
They did. In the late 60s, when they set up the program, they were supposed to get reports, I think, twice a year. And then over time, they just kept passing NDAAs and other related packages of legislation that said, okay, no, you don't have to report this as often anymore, or you don't have to report it to all of Congress. You have to report it to this subcommittee. And then eventually, I think, effective December 2021, DOD does not have to report to them at all. Mm. But I do think they're collecting the information because it's a weapons system that they want to know how it works and how well it works at doing its killing.
I think that's an excellent point. To that end, tell us about this concept of the kill box and how it plays into all this.
Mm. So that's another term that I learned from Todd Callender. And he applied it, I think, to a slightly smaller context than what I expanded it to. He talked about it as, if you get sick and you have COVID, or you even just have a broken leg or something, and you go into a hospital or an emergency room or whatever, you are then in the public health system, and therefore you are in the kill box. And he was talking about it in the context of the ICD-10 diagnostic codes and the way that those were used and still are used to sort of tag people and then set off the death protocols of remdesivir and restraint and starvation and dehydration and all that stuff. So he was saying, don't go into the kill box. If you get sick, stay home, use these alternative protocols or whatever. And so once I looked it up, I thought, this is a good way to visualize what they're doing to the whole world, because they're basically saying, without limits in geography, without limits in time, governments or things that look like governments or things that are operating from behind a government smokescreen have the right to do anything they want to any person they want. And they do that because they've set it up as a national security or national emergency or war type footing, legally speaking. It's a military campaign, and we are all in the kill box.
And that ties, you know, the thing about your work is that all these dots connect. The more you read, all these things just kind of come into focus. You speak about how that ties into the 2001 authorization for military force.
Yes.
And it kind of de facto turns everyone on the planet into an enemy combatant if they decide to designate you as such.
Yeah, or the default is that you are designated as such. They could decide to say that you're not, because terrorism is such an undefined term. Because the distinctions,
and we don't define it, by the way, they define it.
Well, we don't define it, and they don't define it either. Like, the United Nations has been trying to come up with a terrorism convention since, I think, the mid-90s, maybe earlier. Like, the plane bombings in the 80s and 90s started them doing it, and they can't get the countries, especially the United States, to agree on a definition, which makes sense, because it's so hard to find the line between state-sponsored terrorism and non-state-sponsored terrorism. Like, anything that a government does that looks like war could be construed as terrorism. And they want it to be in such a way that a government can do it, but a non-government can't do it. And they can't find a way to, like, thread that needle. So they just haven't done the convention or ratified it, whatever.
Tell us about, what has your work uncovered about the World Health Organization?
I don't focus on that as much as other people. Like, James Roguski is my go-to guy. Like, he's the one who's tracking all of the amendments to the international health regulations and the new pandemic treaty thing. But it fits into the framework that I look at, which is mostly American domestic law, because of the way that the 2005 international health regulations of the World Health Organization, as implemented through American domestic law, sets up an automatic trigger system so that as soon as the World Health Organization declares a public health emergency of international concern, this whole cascade of stuff falls into place within the territorial United States. And sovereignty is gone. It's now subordinated to the World Health Organization and the Bank for International Settlements without people really seeing that that's happened, because it was automatic. It was like the default position, not something that the Senate had to ratify or Congress had to debate or a president had to whatever. It's just an administrative decision.
And this, I thought, was so smart. The premise of all these quarantine policies and the mass vaccination, the masks that you alluded to a moment ago, the premise was we have to protect international trade. We have to make sure that economic cooperation continues for underprivileged nations and all nations, basically. But you say that's just kind of a red herring, and the real goal here is to begin to slowly but surely transfer sovereignty from nation states to globalist organizations like the World Health Organization.
Yeah, but I don't think it's to do it slowly and gradually. I think it happened in like a single move on that January 31st, 2020. I think the gradual part was the setup from like the 1980s up through 9/11 and then on into SARS-1, MERS, H1N1, and then COVID. And they tested out different elements of the trigger system. And I think COVID-19 was the first time they had like virtually all of the pieces that they want. And so when the one of the points where I diverge from other people who write about this stuff is that I think it already happened. I think the sovereignty is already gone. Whereas other people, and I think what they're trying to do now is sort of solidify it, firm it up, get people more used to the idea. That's how I interpret what they're doing with the IHR amendments now and the pandemic treaty now, which is not to say I think that it's a bad idea to fight those things. I think it's a good idea to fight those things. But I think there's a slightly different orientation if you think that we're already living under a global health dictatorship than if you think it's something that could happen if we don't. I don't know if I'm making that clear, but
you're being very clear. And I, you know, not until you just said that just now, do I realize that I kind of believe that as well. I mean, you know, it seems like what they do is they kind of put their stake in the ground, and then they yes. allow you space and time to kind of get used to it.
Yes. There's something, somebody sent me a conference title like that, like a pharmaceutical industry group was doing called Revolutionary Incrementalism. And right. it was a meeting they were having to talk about like, hey, turns out there's not very good like manufacturing controls on these new products we've been making. Let's have a conference. And they know there's no manufacturing controls because they know that it's weapons, but they're doing this as part of the like pretense. But the language that they use of like revolutionary incrementalism is, it's pretty literally like you are frogs in a pot. We're going to turn up the heat slowly, 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 and you're all going to die. And that's the structure of how they do it. And that's what Rogusky Jim is finding out too, is he discovered that the way that they adopt proposals for the amendments is something they call it consensus adoption. But the basic principle is that a small committee says, here's what the amendments are going to be. They bring it out to the full floor of the World Health Assembly for their general meeting in May every year. And they announce that these are the changes they're going to do. And if nobody objects at that point, it just goes into force a certain period of time later. It's not like anybody has to like make a motion on the floor of the World Health Assembly. And then there has to be a debate. And then everybody has to go on the record about what they think and what they like and what they don't like. Nobody ever has to vote. No country has to like say, we're in favor of this, we're against this. It's assumed that the changes happen unless something else comes in to stop it. And that default mechanism is that same like incremental. You can't stop it because you can't see it happening because it's happening by default.
In other words, it's an edict.
Yes. Or yeah. Yeah. Proclamation, they do that too. Like
you talk about something that I think is spot on. Talk about how they preemptively kind of neutralize dissent with this label of conspiracy theory. I don't think it's a coincidence, the more you think about it and the more you analyze it, that the term conspiracy theory comes into the lexicon right around the time all this begins to happen in the 1960s, no?
Yes, exactly. It came out directly, as far as I can tell, from Vietnam protests and from Kennedy's assassination. Anybody who was looking at the data points and connecting dots about Kennedy or about Vietnam, the management of the Vietnam War, got branded and marginalized with this conspiracy theory term. And it was super, super effective at like making it difficult for people to communicate what they're seeing to other people who weren't already at that level, because other people were like, no, I can't listen to that. That's out there. That's too far. So, yeah.
What you also talk about this this combination of the funding streams between the military, this public and private funding stream for military-led experiments on humans, speaking of conspiracy theories. Tell us a little bit about that.
I don't think of them as experiments either. I think of them as just attacks. But the public-private is... The mechanism seems to be through that same public health emergency medical countermeasures enterprise. And it seems to be, I think Sasha Lachapova talks about this in more detail and better. She has a better grasp of it than I do. But it's a kickback scheme, essentially. Like the private companies invest some money, the government invests some money, it gets washed around, it goes back out into campaign contributions, it goes back out into shareholder profits. It goes back out into the Bank for International Settlements or the other central banks. And then by the end of it, there's a weapon. People are mandated to take it. And they can say to you, we're so nice, we're not even going to charge you out of pocket for this weapon that we're going to kill you with. Right. Above that, I think it actually is, like I said before, it's the good versus evil, Satan versus God. And so Satan is capable of tempting, manipulating, whatever you want to say, human will to participate in these kinds of things by getting people to do it for greed, for their career advancement, for lust, for whatever other vice the demonic realm wants to use to get people to cooperate with it. And then that is how it trickles down to, okay, they do that because they've sold their souls and they're getting the benefits they wanted to get from that contract, and they're doing the work that they have to do on the rest of us as part of that contract.
You know, for a long time, I shied away from defining this this struggle in those terms, but I have come to fully embrace it now because I don't think it's anything less than that. I don't think it's anything less than a spiritual battle at this point. Let's talk about
that is not what I thought at the beginning. Like I have come to that conclusion also through watching what happened and trying to piece together the motivations and trying to piece together who benefits and who loses. And so, yeah, that's not a place where I was 3 years ago. It's a place where I am now. But
there's really nothing else that you can chalk it up to. I mean, first you start with money and then you start with power. And then, you know, for them to be rolling out these poisons, mm-hmm. and you see them dancing and on the video, you know, and they get all your favorite celebrities to talk you into, and they know what's in these things, and they know that it's harmful. And I mean, you're never going to be able to convince me. The rank and file at the FDA, maybe they're not, you know, maybe you can make a case for them, but someone like Fauci, there's no way you're going to be able to convince me that he doesn't know what he's doing.
And so the rank and file, as time goes on, the rank and file have less and less plausible deniability for not knowing, like, because they know what it's supposed to look like and they know that this is not it. They now know that it's evil and they're participating in it. And some of them, Sasha talks about this too, some of the FDA reviewers committed suicide because they realized midway through the like pressure on them to issue the authorizations and the review papers and all of that stuff, they realized that this was complete evil and they could not find a way to live with themselves.
We have not heard about that. I guess that's not a surprise, is it?
No.
Tell us about action steps, because I thought you said something that was great. You said what they despise most is when local and state governments, to use the United States as an example, when mm-hmm. they enact their own policies independent of the federal and, of course, independent of, by extension, the global.
Yeah, they do. They keep lists of which states and localities are complying and which ones are starting to go off message, and they lobby to get those renegade states back on board. It's not that hard for them to do that because legislatures are not that big. Like the number of federal judges in the country, I think, is something like 3,000. The number of federal or state legislators is a few hundred at most in each state. Having said that, there are really good legislators who absolutely understand the scale of the war and the scope of the war, and they're getting more and more up to speed about the actual mechanisms and how, for example, federal funding for Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and schools is blood money to the extent that if they accept it, especially the emergency appropriations through the CARES Act and stuff like that, those were specifically given to states with strings attached. You do the policies, you do the death protocols, you do blah, 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 or you don't get the money, or you have to repay it. And I think some states are starting to figure that out to the point where they're saying, I know there's some counties in Florida that have said, we're giving back the money that we've been given and we're not taking any more money because that's how they're controlling us.
Is that the best course of action for people to take, to lobby their state legislators, their lawmakers?
Yes, I think that. I think public education. I think the other thing that the bad guys hate super much is people just talking accurately about what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so the more people can do that, like use the right words, use the right concepts, speak truthfully and not use the lie words and the lie phrases that the bad guys, they need that illusion to be maintained, and they need a lot of people to participate in maintaining it. And so every time another group of people says, I'm not going to participate anymore, they lose a little bit of their like control over the whole illusion.
Absolutely. And pay attention to their control, their desire to control language.
Yes.
Because it's all wrapped up in that. I mean, if you control language, you control events, you control opinions, you control life. And that's constantly what they're after. So whatever they outlaw, whatever speech they try and outlaw, pay the most attention to that, I feel.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, speaking of speech people should pay attention to, I want you to tell the folks, Catherine, where they can find your work online and what your coordinates are, so people can read some of your great research. Because as I say, you can't read a sentence without dots connecting in your mind. So I want everybody to pay close attention to the work that you're putting out these days.
So I have a Substack called Bailiwick News, Bailiwick News, news.substack.com. That's pretty much the only social media that I have. I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook. I am on Gab, but I don't use it that much. I'm not on Telegram because I write. I'm not a social media person. So
you're a smart
Bailiwick
one.
News is the place, and I do a lot of long form, which is the other thing that's weird about my work. So I, with every post that I put a link to an orientation page that tells you like the top 10 or so. If you just want to spend a little time figuring out what the heck I'm talking about, those are the 10 things to start with. Because other than that, when I write, I have to sort of assume that I have to write as if people already have the backstory, and I'm adding more pieces to it, and that gets hard for like new people show up and they're like, what are you saying? But yeah,
well, I know exactly what you mean, but at the same time, I would encourage everybody to take the time to invest the time, because the light bulbs will constantly go off as you read through. Thanks for taking the time, Catherine. I really enjoyed this, and I hope that you come back real soon.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me. That was great.